The notes.
You want to do it again?
No, I think it's fine. You're correct.
I'll go here. Well, first of all, I want to thank all of you for coming to Brussels for this. I appreciate it. It's our first time for doing this, and the turnout has been just great. I hope you have a very positive experience, and we learn a lot from this. You have to forgive me because I broke my foot, so if I fall down and scream in the middle, just ignore it. The object of what this conference is really about is the confluence of technology and journalism. And this is something that we think about, but we don't deal with very often. And actually, it's a very significant event because journalism is the child of technology. Without technology, we have nothing. With no Gutenberg, we have no newspapers. With no Marconi, we have no radio. Without Vladimir Zworykin, we have no television. Without Tim Berners-Lee, we have no web. We are beholden to and the product of technologies. The problem is when technologies change, when new technologies come along, we don't respond very well to them. In fact, we have a tendency to run away from them. We're frightened of them. We kind of partially accept them. If you ever read the work, you know who Elizabeth Kubler-Ross is? Did you ever read her work on dying? You go through these five phases when you're going to die, like some industries are. And the first one is anger. And the next one is denial. We do the same thing when new technologies come along. Small cameras come along, we go, no, 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 it's crap, they're toys. And then we go, well, maybe. And then we reach the point of compromise and we say, well, okay, in the corner, three VJs and a laptop, but really we're still broadcasters. Technology is irresistible. And it is deadly. Because if you don't get the technology, you will die. It's not an either-or choice. For those who understand it, it is enormously liberating because it represents a whole new opportunity. But it means everything changes. Many, many years ago, the ice business was a fantastic business for a long, long time. In New England, in the United States, in England, in Scandinavia, certainly, right? Big business, right? People had ice ponds and ice farms. And during the wintertime, they would cut up blocks of ice and store them. You've all heard the expression ice houses. This is where this comes from. They would store the ice, and then they would bring them down to cities like London or New York or Paris, and they would sell blocks of ice. Your great-grandmothers or maybe your grandmothers had ice boxes instead of refrigerators. And if you had an ice delivery system, and your father was in the ice business, you had pretty much nothing to worry about because you were set for life. And the ice business had been around for a long time. The Roman emperors had brought ice down from the Apennines. So if you had an ice delivery route and ice deliveries and you made ice ponds, and they probably had conferences here in Brussels on ice storage methods. No, that's true. Ice was so powerful, such a big, it was a $1 billion business in today's dollars. There were ships that went from Boston all the way to India packed with ice. And even if they lost half the ice when they got, you can imagine, when they got to Bombay in July and they opened that thing up, people lined up and go, give me that ice. Ice was a fantastic, established, mature business. In the late 1870s, Jacob Perkins, an American inventor living in London, invented refrigeration. The moment he invented refrigeration, the ice business was finished. Finished. And all the crying in the world about the quality of real pond ice and the investments you've made in the ice houses and the ships that went to India and your route and your delivery and the tongs and the ice boxes and my father and we've always... It was over. It was over in an instant. And that's the power and the danger of new technologies. Today, in the communication / journalism media business, we find ourselves confronted with three emerging technologies conferring together at the same time. It's almost a perfect storm of technology. Video cameras used to be these big, heavy things like these guys back here have, because they haven't heard yet, that you carry around on your shoulder. They cost a fortune. They're very difficult to operate. Nobody could buy them. I mean, unless you work for a network. Today, those cameras have been reduced down to a little teeny tiny, you've seen them. They're high def, they cost $800, they're point and shoot, any idiot can operate them, they are broadcast quality. And you can buy them in any store. When I started in the television business, we went to edit suites and edit rooms and conform rooms, and those rooms cost $500,000 to $1 million, and I'm sure most of you have sat in them at some time. There's a million knobs and dials and buttons, and who the hell knows what's going on there? And you sit behind a guy and you say, take it to Zob, and he goes like this, and things spin around and stuff. And you can have a cup of coffee while it's happening. Today, the power of that room has been reduced down to a laptop. In fact, a piece of software in a laptop that any 9-year-old can operate. And if you say to them, put it in the Zob, they grab it, they pull it down, and it's done. So the cost of making broadcast quality content, or any video content, has dropped to nothing. The barrier to entry is gone. This means that anyone can do this. We all thought, oh, we work for a network, we're in the TV business, we are special. We are not special anymore. The last piece of this picture is the internet. Because the internet has now gone to video, which means effectively anyone can put a video image into 6 billion homes instantly for free anytime they want. Which sort of wipes out the whole purpose of having transmission towers and TV networks and cable and all that stuff. It is a very frightening moment and yet an enormous opportunity for anyone in our business because everything is going to change, like the ice business. Everything is going to change. And if you don't wrap your head around the change, you're going to die. And all the crying and the saying, we were the BBC, we were a national network, it doesn't matter because technology has no sympathy for you. Now last night at dinner, Simon Bucks from Sky News said to me, why are you doing this in Brussels? Which is a valid question. 7 miles from here, an interesting event took place in the confluence of technology and journalism. In 1815, Napoleon, oh, you read my mind, Richard.
I know I read your notes.
Thank you, you're very good. In 1815, Napoleon escaped from Elba. After many, many years of war, the European powers had put him down and put him in Elba. They thought it was all over. And he escaped and he came back to France for the Hundred Days. And he raised an army in France, and it looked like France was going to reemerge as a world power, and for the rest of Europeans, a threat to world stability. So the 7 European powers got together and they decided they had to stop Napoleon. 7 miles from here, at Waterloo, the armies of Wellington and von Blücher met Napoleon. And everyone in Europe understood that in this moment, in this one battle, the future of Europe for the next generation and beyond would be decided. The financial markets in London were teetering. Everyone hung on tenterhooks because what happened at Waterloo would decide everyone's future. If Napoleon won, the financial markets in London would collapse. If Napoleon was defeated, they would go up. Baron Rothschild in London had enormous investments. And just before the battle started, he was approached by a young entrepreneur, sort of the Google of its time. And the entrepreneur said to Rothschild, I want to show you a fascinating piece of new technology, very cutting edge. And he opened a box, and in the box was a pigeon. And he said, we take the pigeon, and I go to Waterloo. And as soon as we know who won the battle, I put a band on the pigeon's leg, and the pigeon flies back to London, and it gets here 3 days before anyone else knows what happened. I call it P-mail. Because in those days, the fastest news could travel was on a ship. So Rothschild goes, great, I'll invest. Well, of course, Napoleon is defeated at Waterloo. And the pigeon is released and flies back to London and Rothschild opens up the band. Now this is why Rothschild is rich and we're all poor. Because after he gets the news, Rothschild goes on the floor of the London Stock Exchange and says, we lost. We lost. Napoleon has won. And the stock market collapses. And then Rothschild goes and buys up every share he can find. 3 days later, the ship comes in and says, we won. Everybody goes, Rothschild, what happened? I don't know. P-mail didn't work. journalism, and the power of technology. When you seize a new technology. Not everyone is so adept, not everyone is a Rothschild. On the contrary, most of us in our businesses look at new technologies and we very much follow the Elizabeth Kubler-Ross model. We kind of deny them, we kind of marginalize them, we kind of try to bargain with them. That's the fourth step, right? You try to bargain and you say, okay, I'll have an internet section over here with these three kind of fuck-ups and jeans in the corner and they'll sit over here and they'll be the website, it'll be fine. But it's not fine. Because technology is irresistible. And if you don't embrace it, you're gone. Kodak is a classic example. Everybody know Kodak? Right? In the 1950s, Kodak was, you said Kodak and you said photography. Kodak was the definitive photographic industry in the world. Giant. Fortune 500 company, giant company. When digital cameras came along in the 1980s, Kodak didn't go there. Because Kodak said, we are film. They could have owned digital photography. Today, if I come and say to you, I just bought a Kodak camera, you say, oh, you idiot, what are you, out of your mind? Poor thing. It's an embarrassment. The power of Kodak collapsed because they forgot what business they were in. They thought they were in the film business. They're not in the film business. They were in the business of giving people the power to go and capture images and look at it. We are not in the television crew business. In fact, we're not in the television business. We're not in the newspaper business. We're not in the radio business. We're not even in the internet business. We are in the business of going out in the community, finding stories, and putting them in people's homes. And whatever technology does that the best is going to succeed. Those who don't embrace that technology and understand what it means, it is not an either or, are going to disappear. How much time I got? Oh, crank it along. In 1875, Alexander Graham Bell invented the telephone. And you all have telephones, you all understand what telephones mean. The telephone meant that for the first time, he could talk to her over a wire. This was a fascinating piece of technology because it changed, for the first time, a basic human ability to communicate. Up until the telephone, the fastest anyone could deliver a message to anybody else was to put a guy on a horse, slap the horse on the rump, and have it ride as fast as it could. From the Roman Empire until the telephone. And suddenly, people could communicate at the speed of electricity down a wire. So people got the telephone right away. They understood what it meant. The telephone, the invention of the telephone, required a complete rethinking of our basic understandings of how the world is organized. Prior to the telephone, if you had the only thing, rarity was a value. So if you're the king and you have the only diamond in the world, that diamond is worth a lot. But if you're the king and you have the only diamond and then everybody has a diamond, that diamond is worth nothing. But if you're the queen and you have the only telephone in the world, how much is that phone worth? It is. Who are you going to call? Right. Hello. Hello. Not working. If you have the only phone and now he has a phone, how much is your phone worth now? A little bit, but only if you want to talk to him. But if you have a phone and he has a phone and she has a phone and he has a phone, how much is your phone worth now?
Worth more.
And if you have a phone and everybody in the world has a phone, how much is your phone worth now? It's worth so much that you cannot afford not to have one, right? This changes the basic concept of wealth since the time of ancient antiquity. Now, for the first time, value is predicated not upon rarity, but about commonality. Well, for everyone to have a phone, it requires one thing, and that is wires. But there are no wires. Today we live in a wired world. We accept wires everywhere. But in 1875 there were no wires. So to make the phone of any value, the world has to be wired. This was a very, very expensive and complicated proposition. In fact, between 1875 and 1900, all of Western Europe and the United States are wired. It's probably the single biggest engineering feat in human history. Because whole new technologies had to be invented. Wires, switches, connecting boxes, electrification. You can imagine how fast this had to go. The British dropped a cable under the English Channel, then they dropped one across the Atlantic, and then they take the cable all the way from London to South Africa to Australia. It's a fascinating moment. And by 1898, the entire Western world, the United States, is wired, but it's very expensive. It's very expensive. And so to raise money, they sell shares, and they sell stock, and they take investments. And people think this is a reasonable thing to invest in. You would invest in this because it seems like a good place to put your money. The phone company seems like a good risk, because if you invest in the wires, people are going to pay to use the wires for the next 500 years, right? So by 1898, most of the world is invested, and everyone is leveraged to the hilt, and all the wires are built. And then in 1898, an Italian inventor comes to London with a little black box, and he says, "Watch this. Now, you cannot talk to her without a wires. I call this a wireless." And everybody in the world went, "Fuck, get the guy out of here." Nobody wanted it. Nobody wanted to hear about it. Suddenly, all the wires were worthless. Everybody's going to be wiped out. So Bell Telephone, who owned the patent, an American company, they bought the patent for the Audion, which is the thing that made wireless work. Bell Telephone, who was the patent holder, did what any American corporation would do. I mean, if Bush was president today, they would have bombed Italy and they would have put the money in. They didn't know that. But what Bell Telephone did was they bought the patent for wireless and they repressed the development of wireless technology for 20 years. The only place that wireless was allowed to flourish was on ships. Because on a ship, you can't connect the ship with a wire. It doesn't go very far. So they thought, okay, you can sell the ship. So the Marconi company, with this fantastic piece of technology, was actually this little tiny company that was selling wireless to ships. And that's pretty much the only thing they could do. In 1912, the Titanic, the big ship, hits an iceberg. You've all seen the movie, right? And you remember in the movie, the radio guy, the wireless operator, is in the ship going, "Help, help, help, help," going down. David Sarnoff is a 16-year-old Russian immigrant who is living in New York and working for the Marconi company. And because he's the 16-year-old kid and he has the crappy job, he gets assigned the job of sitting in the window of Woolworth's department store taking in radio traffic on the weekend. Wireless in 1912 was sort of internet 1985. Nobody really understood it. It was kind of interesting, but very small business. Sarnoff is the first one to pick up the signals from the Titanic. And this is a fantastic moment. It's a fantastic moment in history. Because the sinking of the Titanic in 1912 is the equivalent of 9/11. It's this tremendous event. And the thing that makes it the most interesting is it's the first news event that happens live. Today we're used to live all the time. The shit hits the fan, we turn on CNN, there it is, or Al Jazeera. And there it is live. But before Titanic, it had never been live before. And suddenly, the information is coming from the ship, and it's coming to Sarnoff, and Sarnoff is handing out pieces of paper to people on the street. 100,000 people gather in front of the window of Woolworth's department store. They don't go to the New York Times or Times Square. They go to the window. And in that moment, David Sarnoff, at 16 years old, has a moment of insight. He says, this wireless thing, this is not about one person talking to another person. It's not a competitor for a telephone. Wireless is about one signal, the same signal, going to everyone at the same time. And he has a vision at the age of 16 of building little boxes he calls radio music boxes that will only have two knobs, frequency and volume. Up until then, if you had radio in your home, it was an antenna, and you got a license, and you were a broadcaster, suddenly the notion of radio changes. It's at that moment when broadcasting is born. It's not born with the invention of the radio in 1898. It's born with Sarnoff. And it takes Sarnoff another 15 years to build the first real radio stations. And then, of course, he goes on to found GE and RCA. And we all understand where radio went after that and television following it. So it's not the technology that makes the change. It's understanding and applying it properly. There's generally a 20 to 30 year gap between the emergence of technology and its application. For many years, I was the president of New York Times Television. And I was there when the Times first went to the web. And if you go to nytimes.com on the website today, what you see is a newspaper. The web does lots of stuff. It does video, it does interactive, you can buy things, you can talk to people, it creates communities, and the Times is full of intelligent people. But like the people in the telephone company, they look at the new technology and they cannot wrap their heads around what it does. So they take the web and they do the only thing they've been doing for 150 years is they put a newspaper online. They don't get it. And no matter how hard you try to tell them, they keep putting the newspaper online and trying. They try really hard, but they can't get it because the web is not about a place to read a newspaper. Television stations are beginning to migrate to the web now. But if you look at their websites, they take their TV shows and they say, now here's a place you can watch the show. They don't understand what the web is. What the web is a place where people communicate. If you look at eBay, all the junk in the world up here and all the people who want to buy it down here, that works. Amazon, all the books in the world up here, all the people who want to buy them down here, the web makes the connections. J-Date, all the girls who are looking for dates up here, all the guys who are looking for them down here, the web makes connections. In the world of journalism, we should have a site that has all the journalism in the world up here and all the people who want to see it down here, and the web makes, this is logical. But broadcasters and newspapers, they can't wrap their heads around it because they're trapped in this Marconi vision of one signal to everyone. If I told you tomorrow I was hiring you to be the executive producer of eBay, and you said to me, what do you do? And I said, you will decide. First we'll do Barbie dolls, and then we'll go to toasters, and then we're going to... Because that's what I believe our audience wants. You say, you don't understand. You don't understand. We don't need an executive producer for eBay. It works pretty good on its own. When journalism moves to the web, it's a different model. It's a different architecture. It is not a kind of change that happens a little bit and a kind of fine-tuning. These small cameras in the hands of millions of people are not replacements for these guys with the big crews and that we don't have to spend so much anymore. It is a different world. And unless you embrace that world like Kodak, you will find yourself very soon marginalized and out of business.
2 minutes, Mike.
2 minutes, that's it. Is that
it?
Too bad. I got a lot more stories, but you'll have to hear them later. Very briefly, do the short version. In the world of meteorology, they talk about storms. There's the 50-year storm, and then there's the 100-year storm. And insurance assayers and real estate people, they get together. Like in London, they built these giant blocks on the Thames because the 100-year storm is coming. In the world of journalism and technology, there is the 500-year storm. We are headed for the 500-year storm. There is a giant tidal wave that is coming out there. 500 years ago, Gutenberg brought the printing press to bear. Gutenberg thought the printing press was about making cheaper Bibles, and so did everyone else. But that's not what it did. What the printing press did was it put the ability to publish in the hands of anyone who wanted to try, and that changed the world. And that's the world we live in today. We live in a world of a free press, derivative of that piece of technology. But the invention of the printing press meant the end of monasteries and the church only publishing Bibles. It brought about a whole new world of a free press, which is what we live in today. We don't live in a world of print anymore. We live in a world of video and online. And these little cameras, and these laptops, these are the Gutenberg printing press of the 21st century. They make it possible for anyone with an idea to publish in the most common medium in the world. And like the 500-year storm 500 years ago with Gutenberg that changed everything, this technological storm is going to wash away most of what we understand today and replace it with something entirely different. Whether you participate in it or are taken away by it is entirely in your hands. But it is going to come. Thank you for coming.